Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 19th of February 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at RadioAlbion.com because I have with me tonight my co-host from BitChute, Horace. Horace, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good evening, Sven. Yeah, I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, I just had a nice dinner and started using Odyssey more as well. People can find my videos on Odyssey, which I find pretty handy platform. How are you doing?
Ah, very good indeed. Glad you brought up Odyssey there. We also have some Radio Albion content there. We have somebody managing an Odyssey account for us. So check out Horace there. Check out Radio Albion there and give us a sub. And I have some good news to begin the show with tonight. We are expecting Dennis Wise back next week. He still has some more medical interventions to go, but he's feeling as if he's back up to doing the show again, and he's already sent me the notes through for the show, so that's really good news. We've got Dennis back next week, and it's good timing as well because we're hoping to finish the Culture of Critique series tonight. Also, I just want to put an advert out there for The Greatest Story Never Told, the DVD. That's for sale again, and if you go to RadioAlbion.com site and look in the sidebar there, you'll find there's an advert for TWO Films. If you click that, it will take you to where you can purchase A Greatest Story Never Told DVD. I think there's 4 DVDs in the set or 5 DVDs in the set. It's a wonderful documentary anyway, and of course I'm sure all you listeners are aware of that. And tonight we're going to get into Jewish involvement in immigration, specifically what Kevin MacDonald has to say about it, and also how we can see that happening in Britain and in Europe as well, and the reasons why the Jews like immigration so much. Would you like to make a comment on that at all, Horace, or on this series so far, or anything before we begin?
Yeah, I think it's been such an interesting series of talks that we've done so far, and I really appreciate you having me as part of it. I've got to compliment Dennis on his timing for coming back next week as well, and I wish him a very happy return. But yeah, I'll let you kick us off. But yeah, I mean, I would just say one thing is that I think this is perhaps the section of cultural critique that's drawn the most attention and in which like Kevin MacDonald's work has just had a huge impact. So my compliments to him as well.
Well, we have to give compliments to the Jews as well. I mean, they spent 100 years trying to change the immigration rules, laws and guidelines in America, and they succeeded in doing it. And that really is a testament to their single-mindedness, really, because, I mean, it was generations of them that worked on changing it. Obviously, it's had a negative impact on whites, but it's had a positive impact on Jews. And, you know, they worked at it and they succeeded at it. Jewish involvement in shaping immigration policy is it's their number one concern, basically, to do this. And the reason for that, we've talked about before, they don't like to be the only minority. If they're the only minority amongst a host nation, then they stand out. So if you have more minorities there, then they don't quite stand out so much. And that really sort of simplifies it. But if you've got a tiny minority and you've got a massive majority, how are they going to get to actually change that immigration policy? Because they're such a small group. And of course, the reason why the Jews were able to do this is because of all the things we've talked about in this series so far, how they had a very powerful influence in publishing, how they had a big influence in universities, how they had a big influence on the politicians. And the first quote that I have here comes from Walter Kerr in 1968, and he says, "What has happened since World War II is that the American sensibility has become part Jewish, perhaps as much Jewish as it is anything else. The literate American mind has come in some measure to think Jewishly. It has been taught to. And it was ready to. After the entertainers and the novelists came the Jewish critics, the politicians and the theologians. Critics, politicians and theologians are by profession molders. They form our ways of seeing. So what are you saying there is they basically became these important people within our society, the people that we looked up to tell us how we should be seeing things. And it actually changed the way that the American people thought about things. Instead of withholding their passions and controlling their passions, instead of wanting to stick to Christian morality, they began to see the Anglo-Saxon ways of doing things as being a little bit backwards and wanting to be a bit more progressive. And they were told that their ways were racist, and they didn't want to be racist. They should be opening up their borders and allowing all these people in because everybody's the same under the skin, as we talked about with the episode on Boaz, this idea that race didn't matter and it was just a social construct. So they basically changed the mindset of the people. And then at the same time as doing that, they lobbied the politicians with their Jewish advocacy groups, which, because a lot of them are bankers, these Jewish advocacy groups have got a lot of money. So they put pressure on the politicians. And as we'll see later on, they're responsible for much of the funding of the political parties. And this was basically how they did it. They had a few setbacks along the way back in the early 1900s. But by the time they got to 1965, that was it. The floodgates were opened, basically. Horace, do you want to add anything to that, or pick anything out in that you want to mention?
Well, in terms of Jews forming the way that people talk and think and what they talk about, the terms they put it in, who could possibly dispute that? I mean, I think that is everywhere. That fact is reinforced every direction you look, perhaps more so in America than in Britain, but still in Britain. I mean, nobody would use the term hate speech were it not for Jewish influence. That just would not exist. It's not a logical term. Likewise, the use of the word racist. I mean, there may have been some objective use of that term. There may have been some objective use of that term long ago, but over the last century, it's become a sort of weapon word. I attribute that almost entirely to Jews, not only in areas like that as well, but I think even like celebrity worship, hero worship of famous people in general, sports people as well, maybe not sports, but... I attribute a lot of that to Jewish influence, both in terms of control of the entertainment industry and PR, publicity and so on, publishing, media, press. I really think so many of these things would be different. So, yeah, that general point, I think, is absolutely on the nail, yeah. In terms of shaping immigration, you saying that's one of the sort of key areas of Jewish activism. I couldn't agree more. And I've done a couple of the first videos that I made for my channel were about that, one being called Against Brian and Avi. People can see that early on in my BitChute channel, my Odyssey channel. But I'm slowly working on a series that's going to much further develop that idea as well, about Jewish lobbying for what you could call the, quote, open society in Britain. I think, again, yeah, that is absolutely borne out by the facts.
Well, I think one of the things that they do is they've changed who we had as role models. Your father used to be your role model, and now you're told that your role models should be pop stars or they should be sports stars. Everything's become commodified. Everything's become individualized, because the one thing that they most fear is non-Jews getting together in groups, whether it's due to a group based on religion or due to a group based on ethnicity. If the non-Jews are getting together in groups, that means that they are realized that they are competing against the Jews. And once the non-Jews realize that they are competing against the Jews, then because the Jews are such a small minority, it means that the non-Jews win. So just about everything they do has that motive behind it. I've got a quote here from Cohen, who is obviously Jewish. He says, Jews have consistently advocated an internationalist foreign policy because an internationally minded America was likely to be more sensitive to the problems of foreign Jews. So we've got this to add to it as well. It's not just that if there are more ethnic minorities in America, then the Jews don't stand out so much. But if America is promoting an internationalist foreign policy and allowing people to come into the country, it's also going to be more sensitive to what's going on in these other countries. and they're going to be more likely to intervene in the affairs of these other countries if they perceive that any of the minorities are in trouble. And this is why we see Donald Trump talking about bringing homosexuality to America. We hear all these complaints about, there aren't enough feminists in the Philippines or in South America. They're being mean to the women. All of this, looking at these minorities in these foreign countries, that's been promoted by Jews because it means that the American foreign policy will also be interested in what's happening to Jews as a minority. One of the ways they've done this is to promote all the different ethnic minorities and all the different minority groups, so that Jews themselves become just another minority group among them, and also in these other countries. And now we see America's actually got an anti-Semitism czar, I think, that's supposed to go around the world looking for anti-Semitism, and it's the same in Britain. And this guy that's talking about this, he's been quite open about it, is obviously Cohen. He's obviously a Jewish name there. Do you want to comment on how America is more sensitive to the problems of foreign Jews, Horace?
Well, it must be, because, I mean, I can't imagine that the same motivations and wishes that Jews have don't apply when they're living in, say, Japan or Thailand or Kenya. But in Western countries, what they try to do in terms of throwing open our countries, you know, dissolving the homogeneity as much as possible, really, really works in a way that it hasn't in China. So there's no doubt that white countries, certainly including America, probably most of all America, are susceptible to this kind of activism, and have been for a long time as well. I mean, this process started early in the 20th century. So yeah, there's no question.
Got another quote from Kevin MacDonald next. He says, ethnic and religious pluralism also serves external Jewish interests because Jews become just one of many ethnic groups. This results in the diffusion of political and cultural influence among the various ethnic and religious groups, and it becomes difficult or impossible to develop unified, cohesive groups of Gentiles united in their opposition to Judaism. So I think what he's saying there is when they sponsor these black civil rights groups, they also inculcate Jewish values in the black civil rights group. When they support the homosexual groups, they also get the homosexual groups to think kindly of Jews and to stand up for Jews. So they influence all these other ethnic minorities groups to support Jews at the same time as supporting their own interests, and also making it as difficult as possible for whites to actually get together into a cohesive group that's going to advocate for white people's interests. Do you want to comment on that, Horace?
Yeah, I mean, even the term civil rights are a tribute to Jews, and human rights all the more so. I think those are both just Jewish terms for something else. I mean, civil rights means forced integration. Human rights means a lot of different things depending on the context, but it means generally a pretext for, if not war, then some sort of international pressure. That's usually what human rights means. Benjamin Ginsberg, in his book, How the Jews Defeated Hitler, which is a pro-Jewish book, and obviously written by a Jew, very, very interesting, very, very fact-rich book. He says that was very consciously done in the late 1930s around Roosevelt. There were Jews, I can't remember what the name of the organization they used. It's mentioned in my video called The Judean-German War, but there was one particular lobbying organization, basically for war against Germany, which, when it began to use this pretext, quite openly a pretext, not the real reason, of human rights being violated in Germany, only Germany, not the Soviet Union, ridiculous, obviously. But the various Jewish activists who were close to Roosevelt were delighted that approach was being taken, and that Roosevelt began to take up that rhetorical thing of human rights. Because they knew what it meant. It meant a massive escalation in Jews' ability to intervene, to use the power of the American state to intervene all around the world. And that's never gone away. I mean, Jimmy Carter was one who was known for that. But as I said, it goes back to the 1930s. It's used today. It was used under Obama. And it's used, just wherever you want. I mean, anywhere that you want to start a war, you just say human rights being violated. And in terms of homosexuality, I mean, homosexuality itself is something that's existed through history, at least in small numbers, probably nowhere near the numbers that we see it now, but it has always existed. Same with, to some degree, transgenderism or, you know, various shades on that spectrum. But what we call LGBT, you know, LGBT activism, that is a 20th century, a late 20th century thing, and 21st, obviously. I attribute that generally to Jews. I mean, that way of talking, I mean, when people refer to the LGBT community, right, that there is no such thing. There is no one community. I know gay people who are definitely not in that community. It doesn't refer to a community. What it refers to is a collection of activists who dominate discourse in regard to homosexuals, to transgender people, and so on. So it's a way of giving themselves credence and credibility by referring to themselves as the community. It's their way of saying, we speak for everyone else. Everyone knows that they don't, really, if you stop and think about it. They don't. But they've pushed and they've shoved themselves to the front of the queue and made themselves a spokesman. Same way that, you know, there's references to the Jewish community. Again, Jews may act more as one unit than whites do, but still, there is all sorts of disagreements among them. I know Jews who would not be part of what is called the Jewish community. So I think that way of doing activism, again, I think it's largely done in imitation of what Jews had already proved was very effective, especially in white societies, because we seem to be susceptible to all these kinds of activism. For reasons that Kevin MacDonald has also discussed in his more recent book on altruism.
Yeah, these various groups, they help to break down the unity of the rest of the society, of the white society. And just what you're pointing out there about civil rights, and I mean, basically what civil rights is, it means that white people no longer have freedom of association, and it means that white people no longer have freedom of speech. Freedom of association means that you can sell your house to who you want to sell it to. It means you can employ who you want to employ. And if you don't want to employ somebody or sell your house to them because they're from another race, you shouldn't have to. That is actually what freedom of association is. It means you are free to associate with who you want to associate with. So civil rights did away with that. And it also did away...
In Britain, civil rights is called race relations. We don't hear the term so much anymore, but that was the British name for it. So the Institute of Race Relations and the Runnymede Trust, which was closely related to that, they were formed to do exactly the same thing, pass rules. And they got their way within 1965 and 1968. They passed the Race Relations Act, which were just forced integration or forced association acts.
So they use different terminology to get the same point across. And it's also the same on both the right and the left. I've got another quote from Kevin MacDonald here. He says, because liberal immigration policies are a vital Jewish interest, it is not surprising that support for liberal immigration policies spans the Jewish political spectrum. So you'll get the neocons promoting it. You'll also get the hardcore left-wing Democrats promoting it. You'll get the communists promoting it. You'll get the kosher conservatives promoting it. You'll get Tommy Robinson promoting it, so long as it's not Muslims. He's quite happy to have blacks coming into the country, Jews coming into the country, just so long as they're not Muslim. So it is an absolutely vital Jewish interest. I can recall a video from a while back where it was a representative of one of these organizations in America, something like AIPAC or something like that. And they were saying that it is the most important thing of all is to make certain that America has open borders, that they have this liberal immigration policy. It's absolutely central to the Jewish way of thinking. And it also means, I mean, in the past, it meant that they were able to just move from one country to another. And they could say that they were French when they were in France. They could say they were German when they were in Germany. And it meant that they could move to the country that had the most money, basically, the business-minded. And that this caused a lot of problems in Germany in the Weimar period, because, of course, the Germans were very poor, and they had all these rich Jews that were flooding in from all over Europe and buying all the real estate up, and then saying they were German because they were in Germany. And once the National Socialists took power, then they would come to America and they would be American, or they would go to Russia and then they'd be Russian. And it's central to Jews to be able to do that. And I don't think they really understand why we wouldn't like that, because they've never actually had this homeland of their own. They've never had that. They've always had this moving around from place to place. So it's not something that they would really understand. The more I look into this, the more I think, you know, they are so different to us, and it is wrong to assume that that they think in the same way as us in anything at all. You know, what they think is good, you know, we think is evil. It's like they're a complete, like a negative of a photograph, almost. You know, I can't condemn them.
There must be some overlap. I mean, I've certainly encountered various Jews that never, like powerful ones, but various Jews who do sympathise with elements of what I'm saying. I mean, earlier on in this series, I did mention one Jewish friend I have who fully sympathises with my opposition to immigration. Only really differs from, well, does differ from me in various ways, but primarily differs from me just in our understanding of anti-Semitism and what kind of threat it is. But yeah, I'm sure there is some overlap, but yeah, there's certainly also, it's worthwhile and important to emphasize the difference. And I think especially what you said about the fact that from what we would call the left to the right of the Jewish spectrum, you know, it may be a genuine spectrum of disagreement to an extent, but there are certain things that are agreed on by virtually the whole thing. I do think that is very significant. That is one of the things that led me to realize that, you know, it's generally a mistake that we should generally understand Jewish activism as ethnically motivated, whatever sort of cloak it wears. And when I first made that video called Against Brian Abbey, I got a comment underneath saying all these things like you Jew haters, all these things that you're attributing to sort of Jewish motives. No, we're talking about leftists who happen to be Jews. And I considered that argument and I decided, no, that is wrong, because I can't remember what reason I gave, actually. But, yeah, it's – no, I can't quite finish
it's
that.
It's the immigration that's central, isn't it? That's
yeah,
the
I mean, from left to right, yeah. That is a unifying position among Jews, almost anyway, not quite, but, yeah, nearly universal among Jews, like – And which isn't the case in Israel, obviously, or with regard to Israel.
Well, they give a reason for it that they've always been refugees themselves, so they have solidarity with the refugees. But, you know, I would think, as a white man, I would say, well, if you're a refugee and you're taken in by a country, your loyalty should be to that country for taking you in. It shouldn't be to some people that are completely unrelated to you on the other side of the world who are also claiming refuge. You have no idea why it is they're claiming refuge or what sort of people they are. But what you do know is that the people who have taken you in, they are good people and you should want to pay them back. But that's not the way the Jews see it. They see it that their loyalty is to these other refugees. So again, I would say that that's a, you know, that's a fundamentally different way, I think, that you look at it. I mean, imagine if a family had taken you in, your loyalty would be to that family for taking you in, surely. Not to somebody you'd never met on the other side of the world who was also in the same position. Am I wrong in thinking that? You know, how do you?
No, I absolutely agree. And I think another way of illustrating that difference is that when British people move to other countries, like, I mean, quite a lot of British people settle in, Australia is another white culture, but let's say Southeast Asia, there's quite a lot of British expats, or it's not so much in European countries, but in Asian countries, where it's kind of an exotic element to the culture, like it's so completely different to ours in certain ways. You see British people, they'll either behave like typical expats, you know, in the bad sense of being sort of drunk, wearing vests, not learning the language and stuff. Or if they do assimilate, they assimilate to an extent which often makes people cringe, in the sense that, like, they're, you know, they almost forget their own original identity. What they don't do is form, you know, sort of British solidarity organizations to rigidly maintain their Britishness and assert British power in these other countries. Whereas Jews do that everywhere. They obviously, as we spoke about right at the start of this series, fervently, like very, very avidly resist assimilation and, you know, retain their Jewishness and also just begin working to transform the place. And as I mentioned like a couple of minutes ago, in certain other countries, that just doesn't work. I've read one article, I think, on Occidental Observer, or maybe it was National Justice, actually, Eric Stryker, just writing about how Jews tried to, well, Paul Singer in particular, but other hedge fund or vulture capital, as it's called, managers, tried to take over certain businesses in South Korea. Not only were they completely rebuffed, but the South Koreans who were defending against the takeover attempts just very openly just said, we are not having Jews take over this or that company. We're not allowing that. They're foreign. I don't think they would have been any more friendly to, you know, Africans or Europeans doing it. But there was also a particular consciousness of the danger of allowing Jews to take over their companies. And they resisted it very, very, very plainly because South Koreans, you know, just have a sort of quite openly racist culture compared to us. So.
And these other minorities or these other nations, they understand the importance of their nation. They understand it's their extended family. Why would they allow some other family to come in there and take over that part of trade or that part of business? It just doesn't make any sense.
I wish that was the default here.
Yeah, this is the whole point of it, isn't it?
Yeah, if only that was the default. I mean, in a way, that's part of the work of being a nationalist is to try and make that the default for our people, to try and make that habitual that we think in terms of our own ethnic interests and we assert them strongly.
That is the whole point of what we're trying to do here at Radio Albion. It's aimed at our own people, not at trying to change anybody else. I've got two quotes here from Earl Raab, another Jew. Earl Raab notes that the Jewish community has taken a leadership role in changing the Northwestern European bias of American immigration policy. And also from Earl Raab, the Census Bureau has just reported that about half of the American population will soon be non-white or non-European and they will all be American citizens. We have tipped beyond the point where a Nazi Aryan party will be able to prevail in this country. And there we have it. That's what is important to them. To make certain that no ethnostate can be formed, and they don't care if it would be an ethnostate that would be friendly towards Jews or what. All they're concerned about is we cannot possibly allow another Nazi state to arise, and that's the way that they see white people, as Nazis basically. And if we have enough of a majority in a country, there is always the risk that an ethnostate will be formed, and an ethnostate by definition would exclude other ethnicities, so Jews wouldn't be able to have a part in it. It would essentially be the same as the state of Israel, which is specifically for Jews. I mean, there is a double standard there, and it's the double standard that really irks people, I think, is the fact that in Israel, they have their ethnostate. It's specifically for them. Anybody else that comes there is a guest or an outsider. And in all the other countries in the world where we have Jews living within the countries as guests within the host nation, they will advocate against that nation being an ethnostate. I guess it's just in their best interest. But, you know, we can see here he's really cheering on the fact that America is coming up to 50% non-white. And he's also bragging about the fact that it's the Jewish community that took a leadership role in changing that. And the reason why he can do that without getting any criticism for that, apart from the nationalists on the fringe, is because of how before that they did the work in changing the mentality of the American people to accept all of this. It's not like they just suddenly jumped in there and changed the immigration policy. They did all this work beforehand in changing the narrative and changing the thinking, particularly of the students in the universities with the Frankfurt School and all these other organisations that we've talked about over the last few weeks. Do you want to comment on Earl Raab here, Horace?
Yeah, he's someone I've never heard of other than in this book. But yeah, I mean, it's his statement neatly, very, very succinctly encapsulates many things. I mean, what Jews have tried to do, what they have in fact achieved, how they see things, what they were trying to achieve, and why. There's all there in that one or two sentences. So it's it's a quote that many people should be familiar with. And yeah, I do think it's significant that he specifically says a Nazi party, and all he's referring to is the possibility of any amount of American white nationalism. like, I mean, I think we've said before, or I've said, I'm not sure, but like, you know, many just think many normal things or things that we would do for completely normal reasons are just portrayed as a route back to Auschwitz. Like, you know, any sort of white assertiveness is just, you know, Auschwitz is mentioned in connection with it. Tony Benn did it in 1968 when Enoch Powell made his speech that was falsely called the Rivers of Blood speech. He never said Rivers of Blood. Tony Benn, just within a day or two, said the, I can't remember how he put it, but the flag flying over Birmingham when that speech was made was the same one that was, I'm quoting this wrongly, but the same one that flew over Dachau and Belsen. So if Enoch, so if Britain isn't made majority Caribbean, African, Asian, then it's a new Holocaust. And so that's Tony Benn, who's obviously an aristocratic white man, saying that. And I don't know whether he was doing that under the influence of Jewish lobbying or what, or whether that's his own idiocy. But it is a ridiculous thing to say. Enoch Powell is actually a very, very moderate politician. And whatever they say about him, Enoch Powell actually loved much of the Third World. He loved India, absolutely adored it. And So, I mean, in the same way, yeah, and anything, I mean, we're seeing this now with the use of the word white supremacist in America. It's absurd. I mean, they're using it even about elements of the Democrat Party, I think, now. So it's just, but at the moment it works. I do feel that tactic, although it works, it has other effects which will sort of, the price will come due later, I expect anyway, that a lot of people will come to laugh at the term white supremacist, but we're not there yet. We're in a real nadir at the moment.
I think they're even calling black people white supremacist, aren't they? It's just anything that they don't like is now white supremacist. And the default position is always to reduce what the Jews see as being in competition with them, to reduce it to Nazism or Adolf Hitler. Got another comment
and,
here.
And it just makes me wonder before the Second World War, what would it have been that they likened it to before then? Because I imagine that tactic was still used. We know that.
I think it was the Tsar, wasn't it?
Say again, sorry.
I think it was the Tsar, the Tsar of Russia.
Okay, yeah. Anyone who wants to see more about that might watch the chat that I did with Andrew Joyce, which I'm delighted to do. That's on my channel as well, just a few videos back. But before the Tsar, maybe something else as well. And also I just think that, you know, it's significant that for 40 years or so, maybe 50 years before the Second World War, there was already warnings of a genocide. Often the number 6 million was cited. 6 million Jews are at risk, usually referring to Jews in the Russian Empire under the Tsar. But there's a whole, long series of statements from rabbis, from news reporters, from Jewish organizations, saying millions of Jews, usually 6 million, not always, but usually saying 6 million Jews are at risk of extermination or whatever. I think that, the likening of things to genocide doesn't even rely on those genocides having happened. Even if you and I just accepted that the Holocaust is entirely true, the Holocaust was being used before the Holocaust. So, there's just this always useful trend of likening anything white, any sort of white homogeneity to genocide for the Jews. Amazing, but it works.
Yeah, pogroms, isn't it? I think before the Tsar, they weren't emancipated, were they? Napoleon emancipated them, but before that, they weren't able to do that sort of thing. They didn't have the influence that they were able to achieve once they'd been emancipated. It's only been in, the last 150 years, really, that it's really just the last century. I mean, they call it the Jewish century with good reason, I think. I got another quote here from Charles Silberman. He says, American Jews are committed to cultural tolerance because of their belief, one firmly rooted in history, that Jews are safe only in a society acceptant of a wide range of attitudes and behaviours, as well as a diversity of religious and ethnic groups. It is this belief, for example, not approval of homosexuality, that leads an overwhelming majority of US Jews to endorse gay rights and to take a liberal stance on most other so-called social issues. So again, we have them admitting what they're doing here and why they are supporting of homosexuality. He's quite open about it. They don't approve of it, but they see it as being of benefit to them, because the wider a range of attitudes, behaviours and beliefs that they can get society to accept, then the less people are going to be upset at some of the sort of things that Jews do, such as promoting homosexuality and divorce and abortion and all sorts of other things that they've been very proud of the fact that they have introduced into Western society. I mean, this is one of the reasons why the Germans weren't very happy in the Weimar period, was because of the promotion of divorce and all these degenerate ideas that were coming out in the plays and in the movies, because it was the Jews that were responsible for making these plays and movies, and they introduced these ideas that weakened society and broadened this range of attitudes and behaviours that before then were completely unacceptable and now are acceptable. And this is, again, you can go right the way up to transgender children. I mean, it just continues going, doesn't it?
I think, yeah, it's really, really important point. It's one of the many reasons why, although a lot of people have written and said interesting things about the Jewish question, what this book, Culture of Critique, does, what McDonald deserves so much credit for, is with points like this, he punctures some of the more facile excuses for what Jews do in white societies. So it's absolutely right that, you know, homosexuality is not, there will be some small minority of homosexual Jews who benefit from that for the obvious reasons. But yeah, the promotion of homosexuality is primarily aimed at, again, dissolving white society, that they benefit from it, not because it liberates them. It liberates a tiny minority of them. But in a group sense, it liberates them because it helps dissolve what resists their growing influence, homosexuality being one example. Yeah. And in regards to what you said about refugees before as well, it's not out of love for Syrians, Afghans, Somalis, whatever, that Jews in America have, celebrated their success in opening the country to refugees. And there's that famous clip of where they got 3,000 rabbis, you can never get them to agree on anything except this. And that's that America must be turned into a refugee camp. It's not because they love Somalis. I'm sure they, if they were being really honest, dread Somalis, you know, and Pakistanis and Libyans and so on. At least if they were actually to take over the country, they would have reason to dread them. And certainly, I don't think you're seeing many of those rabbis hosting, you know, Bangladeshis in their houses. I can't imagine hardly any of them do. But, you know, to get them in helps them vis-a-vis the great rival, which is white America.
Well, so it's the cat among the pigeons, doesn't it? I mean, this is the thing. That's why they invite them in and call for them in, because they know it's going to cause all sorts of problems that the out-group are then going to be distracted with and aren't going to be looking at what the Jews are doing and the influence that the Jews have.
Demoralized. Yeah, demoralized as well. And I would just add one thing. There's a book by, I think his name was Jonathan Weissman, from a couple of years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. It's written, I think, maybe shortly after Charlottesville, that outrage where a peaceful rally was attacked by violent communists and the anti-white forces. But this book, I think the intro is quite long, but then chapter one opens with, I haven't got the exact quote, but it says something like, this is the opening line of the first chapter, something like, Jews benefit when barriers come down and borders fall. That's the start of his book. And the book is called Semitism in triple brackets. And he's saying like what it means to be a Jew in the age of Trump or something like that. And it's obviously a complaint about the way that Jews are seen and vilified for their activism, you know, by the alt-right and so on. But he chooses in the same tract to open, you know, his book by saying Jews benefit basically when your countries are destroyed, when you're dissolved.
it is humorous sometimes. I think the memes that come out, they are so truthful, and
there's no contradiction. It's kind of spitting in your face and laughing in your face as you wipe off the spit.
Yeah, that's what I think it is. You know, it is naturally to them. I don't think they think they're being particularly evil or wicked in doing it. It's just the way they are. Well, let's have a look at how all of this was achieved. This is another quote by Kevin McDonald. Jewish organizations have been able to have a vastly disproportionate effect on US immigration policy because Jews as a group are highly organized, highly intelligent, and politically astute, and they were able to command a high level of financial, political and intellectual resources in pursuing their political aims. And he narrows it down to three main things that he sees that they did. The first one is intellectual and academic efforts. So that would have been the Frankfurt School and the universities and the politicians. Then he says breaking the link between state and church. And this is something that people today are probably a little bit confused by, because the church is now mainly all in support of open borders. But if you think back 100 years ago, the church was very patriotic, and the nationalists in Europe were also Christian as well. You think of the National Socialists, the Rexists, the Iron Guard. You had that preacher in America, I forget his name for now.
Father Coughlin
as well. And the church would also put a stop to race mixing. They wouldn't allow that right up until the 60s. So that they wanted to break the link between the state and the church, so that the church wasn't so powerful, and then they were able to infiltrate the church and weaken the church. And the third part is mobilizing the ethnic minority groups. And I have a quote here from Levering Lewis in 1984. And he says, by 1915, the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People had something of the aspect of an adjunct of B'nai B'rith and the American Jewish Committee. Small wonder that a bewildered Marcus Garvey stormed out of NAACP headquarters in 1917, muttering that it was a white organization. And the presidents of the NAACP were all Jews until 1975. So for 60 years, they were all Jews. And this organization was the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And it was all led by Jews.
So, you know, I do wonder if I was a high IQ black person, I mean, probably like Marcus Garvey, like what I would have thought. To encounter an organization with that name, and then just to see who you met actually in it. And if you asked where the money came from, who that came from, because I think Jacob Schiff and other rich Jewish financiers supported it as well. I think the Marcus Garvey thing is really interesting, because there's two different ways that black politics could have gone. And one is so much more benign than the other one. And the other is the one that we went down, which is this what they call civil rights, i.e. forced integration, and now just outright anti-whiteness or anti-whitism. If it had gone down the path favoured by people like Booker T. Washington, Marcus Garvey, and even Malcolm X, who was a very, very anti-white figure, I think everyone, whites and blacks, but not Jews, would have been much, much better off. But the Jewish path was the one that was taken, which is the Martin Luther King and people like him, integrationists, as it were, often sort of close to communists as well. That's the path that we went down, and that's been disastrous for blacks and whites. I think had it gone down the other path, you would have probably seen, well, maybe, I'm not sure, but some sort of autonomous black nations, one-eighth, one-seventh of the US, and both sides would have been happier, but Jews would not.
Yeah, Marcus Garvey was really good. Obviously, the NAACP, that was the one that had all the money behind it. And, you know, what they're saying here is these ethnic minority groups that were headed by Jews, they made it central to have open borders and promote ideas that the Jews wanted promoting. So that was how they got this done. Because it's not to the benefit of American blacks to have open borders, because it means that they're going to be competing all the more for their jobs. It's the same in Britain. It's not in the interests of black British people to have lots of immigration, because it means that they're going to be competing for council houses. They're going to face the same competition that whites face, and yet they will still promote these ideas because they've got this influence there by the Jews. It's very, very well documented. I mean, this is just one little quote that I picked out there, but they headed all the civil rights organizations pretty much until the 70s and the 80s when they were called out upon it.
And all the leftist radicalism that fed into the civil rights movement as well, all through the, especially the 60s, the new left in the 60s, again, that was almost entirely Jewish as well.
Well, let's move over to Britain and have a quick look at what was happening in Britain. We have an alderman on the British Board of Jewish Deputies. He says, since all British Jews are or are descended from immigrants, it was unethical, even immoral, for a Jew to support immigration control, or at least tighter. immigration control. So same was going on in Britain as was going on in America. And we've got this group here, the British Board of Jewish Deputies. So it's set up specifically to advocate for Jewish interests and to speak for all Jews in Britain and to have an influence on British policy, basically, and to encourage the British state to take an interest in what was happening in Jews in other countries, going back to this idea of taking an interest in foreign Jewries, as it were. And obviously this was some years back, and then we can move forward to a couple of years back, and we had what was called the Dubs Amendment, which was thought up by this Jewish Lord Dubs. And the Dubs Amendment was to make Britain accept all so-called unaccompanied migrants from France into Britain. And there was a lot of people demonstrated against this, but they did actually put this amendment in there, thankfully, that they didn't actually go and pick too many of them up. But his excuse for doing this was, well, I was a Jew escaping from Nazi Germany, and I came to Britain with the Kinder transport, and therefore I'm going to make it my mission in life to allow all these other migrants from France to come into Britain as well. So his loyalty wasn't to the British people for allowing him to come in on this Kinder transport. His loyalty was to all these, you know, most of them lying that they're actually under 18 in France. And as I was looking up the details on this, I did discover a rather good bit of news. It was struck out of the Brexit bill last week, the Dubs Amendment. So we no longer have it. Yeah, last week. It was February the 10th, the news article that I was looking at. So we no longer have the Dubs Amendment.
That's a small win for us. Yeah, he's a real enemy. I really despise Alf Dubs, yeah.
But I think quite a few of the Home Secretaries, who, like Jack Straw, he's another Jewish Home Secretary that was very keen on immigration, opened up the borders to Europe, didn't he, Jack Straw?
Yeah, and Jack Straw did a lot of evil things. He launched the McPherson Inquiry. I don't know if it was his idea, but it was under him. It might have been Blair's idea. I think it was probably Jack Straw's idea. Obviously, Barbara Roche worked under Jack Straw. She was a junior immigration minister. She's the one who massively relaxed the ability of illegal immigrants to stay in Britain once they should be deported. She made it much easier for them to get in and much harder to expel them. Also, Jewish law firms like Mishkonda Rea worked day and night to keep like foreign, especially violent foreign criminals in Britain, prevent their deportation. Also, yeah, I mean, you had Leon Britton, who passed, I can't remember the name of the law, but it began incitement to racial hatred. It began to this ever-expanding pretext for the law to crack down on enemies of Jewish power. And Michael Howard was a Jewish Home Secretary as well. I don't think he actually, if anything, is something somewhat sceptical on immigration, although I don't believe he would have done anything had he been elected when he was a Tory leader. But yeah, there's been others as well. I think one of the most important bits of Jewish lobbying in Britain is Anthony Lester. The career of Anthony Lester in general, I mean, what a malignant figure he is, or was. He died recently, but he lobbied for, I mean, he was instrumental in founding both the Institute of Race Relations and the Runnymede Trust, which are two of the most deeply anti-British, anti-white organisations in Britain. He formed both of them with Jim Rose, who was half Jewish. Andy Lester also campaigned tirelessly and worked with Roy Jenkins for the Race Relations Act. I think both of them, 65 and 68. There was also more after that. He might have had something to do with them. He spent his whole life just working to undermine us, to winkle open our country, and to sort of force open the cracks. The Runnymede Trust in particular, it's just absolutely horrible. And they were empowered under Jack Straw again. They worked with Bhikkhu Parekh, who's, I think, Bangladeshi. He's a lord somehow. They worked with him to establish to pass this report on multicultural Britain, which just simply says Britain must be ended as a homogenous country. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that is what it says. And also, the Runnymede Trust have made a particular point in the late 90s, early 2000s of promoting Islamic schools, madrasas. So it's a Jewish-founded organisation that works to promote Islam in Britain, among other things, among just general anti-white ideology as well. But they are viciously anti-white, the Runnymede Trust. They're absolutely horrible. There's one other thing I can mention. I don't know if you're about to say something, but there's one other thing I can mention about sort of Jewish promotion of immigration in Britain as well.
Go on.
In cultural critique, still talking about American Jewish involvement in America, and I think we're talking the first two decades of the 20th century. One of the organizations that was funding the lobbying for immigration openness in America was the Baron de Hirsch Foundation, I think it was called. And that was, I believe that was Maurice de Hirsch. Maurice de Hirsch was one of the three people who, in the book Churchill and the Jews by Martin Gilbert, which is a very admiring book of Churchill and Jews and Zionism. Martin Gilbert was himself a Zionist Jew, very, very enthusiastic Zionist. In Churchill and the Jews, which I made a video about, people can see that on my channel, and it's a very, very interesting, very informative book. When Lord Randolph Churchill died quite young, I think in his 40s, he was Winston Churchill's father, three of his very close friends were Maurice de Hirsch, Edmund Cassell, and Lord Rothschild. I'm not sure. I think that's Nathaniel Rothschild. I'm not quite sure. There's many, many people in the Rothschild family, but he was called Lord Rothschild anyway. Those three men then sort of saw it as either a duty or an opportunity or both to sort of take Winston under their wing and kind of raise him to some extent, especially as he was neglected by his parents. And Maurice de Hirsch was one of those. And they made Churchill who he was as an adult. He was sort of taken under their wing as a teenager, and they saw him through the first few decades after that. Edmund Cassell, these were all mega rich, mega powerful Jews, by the way. Edmund Cassell managed Churchill's finances, at least into the 1930s. I mean, and Churchill being a profligate man, that meant a huge amount of power over Churchill. Maurice de Hirsch was known for promoting Zionism all over the world. But yeah, a Britain-based mega-rich Jew who was also in the court of Edward VII as well. I think all three of those men were. Was instrumental in lobbying for America to be thrown open to, at the time, Jewish immigration and later to immigration from all over the world. I think that's very important. And Winston Churchill, I think, repaid their faith and also the faith of, and the material support of, Jews in his constituency. The first constituency in his political career was, I'm not sure if I've got this the right way around, but was in Manchester, and then he moved to Oldham. It might have been the other way around. The first constituency chucked him out because he just wasn't acting for the constituents. The second one embraced him because he did so, and that constituency had a huge and very influential Jewish minority led by Nathan Lasky, who was the father of the communist and Labour member, but communist theorist Harold Lasky. And they praised Winston Churchill for basically just constantly serving Jews rather than the people of the area, like the Mancunians or the Oldhamites. And Winston Churchill, this should be repeated to every admirer of Winston Churchill throughout the world, right? Every Gentile admirer, I'm sure the Jews would approve of it. But Churchill, one of the first things he did in politics was to campaign against immigration restriction in Britain. And to the benefit of Jews, it was Jews trying to get in. A wave of a few hundred thousand Jews arrived over decades in Britain, and it was becoming a threat. It was becoming a problem for many voters were absolutely alarmed at it because it was transforming certain areas, and there was no sign of it stopping. Winston Churchill, apart from deriding them, just took the Jewish line in Parliament, and in committee, just took it upon himself to scupper the restriction bill, which he did successfully. Another one was actually passed successfully a couple of years later. But in the first place, he did so basically by filibuster, which is almost unheard of in British politics. I think Jacob Rees-Mogg has done it once, but it's hardly ever done. But Winston Churchill and a couple of other allies, mixture of Gentiles and Jews, used filibuster in British parliamentary committees for Jews to be able to keep arriving in Britain. And it was as simple as that. He was an agent of the Jews his whole career.
It's incredible, isn't it? You know, the Sivnats will say, what is it with Jews then? Why do you go on about Jews? Jews don't form grooming gangs. Jews don't stone apostates. Jews don't people to join.
I give them credit to that extent. Yeah.
It's other things that they do. It's this huge, massive influence they have on bringing in these peoples that do that sort of thing. That's the point. I guess it's a little bit more intellectual than, you know, just looking at what's happening outside on your doorstep to actually look at the history of all of this. Well, the final chapter in the book looks at what happens next with Judaism and the West. And this is a quote here from Kevin MacDonald. Ginsberg notes that Jewish economic status and cultural influence have increased dramatically in the United States since 1960. Shapiro shows that Jews are overrepresented by at least a factor of 9 on indexes of wealth, but that this is a conservative estimate because much Jewish wealth is in real estate, which is difficult to determine and easy to hide. While constituting approximately 2.4% of the population of the US, Jews represented half of the top 100 Wall Street executives and about 40% of admissions to Ivy League colleges. Lipset and Raab in 1995 note that Jews contribute between 1/4 and 1/3 of all political contributions in the United States, including 1/2 of Democratic Party contributions and 1/4 of Republican contributions. And that answers why you have bipartisan support for all these Jewish issues in America, because they're funding, you know, half the Democratic Party and 1/4 of the Republican Party. And that's just the contributions that we know about.
Just the ones from Jews. You can add to that Christian Zionists, who are an enormous voting block and a source of enormous funding as well. And they are in lockstep with Jewish interests.
That's probably all the rest of it, isn't it? That will be the other half, will be the Christian Zionists. And I've got a list here of the things that, you know, that have come about that are, you know, they're against sort of white ideals, Anglo-Saxon ideals. We've got gay rights, gay pride, gay adoption, trans rights, drag queen story hour, trans kids. Now we've got constant race mixing in adverts, with that being cheered on by Biden recently. Now we've got internet censorship of everything that Jews dislike, and we've got boards made up of Jews, the ADL, the SPLC, actually advising YouTube and Facebook on exactly what to remove, because it's not removing things that are against the law, it's removing things that these boards of Jews tell them to remove. And just to bring us right up to date now, we've got all the whites that were united under Trump are now denounced as domestic terrorists. And it seems there's a new strategy of basically conflating non-Jewish information strategies with terrorism. So if you're not Jewish and you're trying to advocate for your people and think up strategies and talk about strategies in this competition for selection, this Darwinian competition, if you're not Jewish, you're going to get accused of terrorism for doing that. And now they're banning all non-Jews from forming groups based on kinship, as that could lead to violence. So this, I think, is the new thing. Where we're heading now is just total censorship. And, you know, I mean, that's half of America that has now been identified as a domestic terrorist for supporting Trump. This is why we have a military occupation of the White House at the moment around Biden, because they know what they're doing is guaranteed to upset the population. Anything else you want to add to that, Horace?
Just in addition to that, I think part of the anti-white strategy is also deliberately provoking people into violence as well, which is absolutely horrible. And when we see, I'm sure you agree, when we see people on our side, you know, of similar persuasion to us resorting to violence, we know, you know, apart from it being immoral, it's also a catastrophe for our side every time it happens. I mean, I don't think, you know, Brenton Tarrant in New Zealand, his proclaimed sort of aim was to stimulate a crackdown that would radicalize people. I don't think it did that at all. I think it just made things much, much worse. And every time someone resorts to violence, it drags our side down even further. So, and I can totally see why our enemies try and deliberately stimulate that.
Well, it doesn't help us in any way. It just causes censorship. It just gets us a bad name. It means that when you say you're a nationalist, you can get link, they can draw a link between you and these other violent people. And that is their main tactic, isn't it? We've seen that recently with Patriotic Alternative in the newspapers, where they're trying to link Patriotic Alternative with these terrorist groups, when, you know, the whole point of Patriotic Alternative is positive ethnocentrism. It's community building. It's all the positive things that there are, not the negative side of ethnocentrism. And it's actually the negative side of ethnocentrism that is being aimed at Patriotic Alternative. Because these newspapers, when they draw these links between terrorists and Patriotic Alternative, that is serving the non-white groups. That's benefiting the non-white groups. And it's their influence on the newspapers to get them to do that. And the saddest part of it is that a lot of the people that are doing it are just maladapted whites that have fallen for this brainwashing that they should be acting against the interests of their own kinship group. And that's what we're fighting against. You got anything quick you want to add to that before we finish, Horace?
I can see we're nearly at the end, but yeah, I agree, and it's really, really sad. But the journalists are acting in coordination with the anti-fascist groups. It's all one organisation under different names. So, yeah.
And all working to serve our competitors. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Horace. Thank you very much to the listeners for listening. I'll be back next Friday with Dennis Wise. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.